For the week of May 19th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 449, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Those are pretty contrasty places. You're seeing movies and I am not having an abortion.
I was just going to say, I'm seeing movies about people that are trying to get abortions, and you're seeing, well, not movies, and you're not trying to get an abortion.
Well, you're in Cannes, France, but for the love of God, how did you watch the series finale of Game of Thrones? 45 million people or more probably watched the episode last night.
First of all, I don't watch Game of Thrones, and I'm kind of glad it's over because now I don't ever have to talk about it.
Well, how did everybody else do it?
You know what? I don't know. I'll be honest. I haven't heard a lot about it.
Oh, okay. Well, what have we heard about this show's episode?
Well, this show's episode, as I just mentioned, Michael, bonjour, okay? That's my beautiful French accent that you're hearing. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got the Croisette covered. I'm in Cannes, so we'll discuss the films at Cannes, the market at Cannes, the sexual politics at Cannes, and of course, the pizza at Cannes, because of course, everybody eats at La Pizza. Yes, that is a thing. On Inside Baseball, we cover the latest on the showdown between writers and their agents. That battle does not seem to be going anywhere, as we predicted. Dozens of agencies have signed the new WGA Code of Conduct, and while none of the members of the ATA have cracked, some major ones are playing ball with the writers. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Just to prove you have fans, someone called me and I said, I'm taping my podcast. And they said, oh my God, Sperling isn't shirking.
Oh my God. Oh, so literally. Oh,
so
wow,
unfair.
Okay.
So unfair. That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. I've got a link to Comscore in our show notes. We also pull information from Deadline Hollywood, The Numbers, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. You, our listeners. The number one movie around the world is John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. People keep asking, is John Wick back? Yeah, I'm thinking he's back. $92 million on the weekend. That's what it's made in its first 4 days, I should say, around the world. Each film has opened bigger than the one before, sort of like the Austin Powers franchise. It doesn't happen a lot, but the budgets have increased every time. $20 million, then $40 million, now about $60 million. And the box office is increasing every time. We'll have to see where John Wick Chapter 3 ends up, but had a great opening, good reviews, fans are liking it, and I'm going to see it in a day or two.
You know, it's funny that you should mention Austin Powers, because that was the first time where, like, a movie made, you know, a nice $40 million, you know, made $40 million, the first episode, if you will, the first installment of the franchise. And then they release a second one in 1999, and it goes on to make, like, $54 million in its opening weekend, more than the entire first film combined.
I don't know. That's the first film ever to find a big audience on VHS or DVD or cable, and then the sequel does better. But it's certainly a good example.
No, that was it was one of the examples that is used
right.
to kind of
yeah. It's a good example. It's not the first movie ever, but it's a good example. Yes. All right. So the Keanu Reeves is back on top. Great reviews. $92 million on its opening weekend. At number two around the world is Pokemon Detective Pikachu. $78 million over this last week. $287 million worldwide. That brings us to one of the biggest films of all time. At number three is Avengers Endgame. $76 million over the last few days. $2,614 million worldwide. It needs to make about another $173 million to become the biggest film of all time. So will it get there?
You know, if it wasn't for the fact that it's Avengers Endgame, I would say that'll never happen. But you know what? $200 million?
Why would you say it'll never happen? Why would you mean?
Because $200 million 5 weeks out, that's a lot of money to be making.
It made $76 million this weekend. Just needs to have another three or 4 weeks in the theaters and it'll get there. No, it's going to happen
it'll get there.
Yeah. And number four is A Dog's Journey. This is the second film in the franchise or the third? I forget. It's a series of books, a series of films. No, the first one cost $25 million. Yeah, you're right. The first one cost $25 million to make and it grossed about $200 million worldwide. We don't know the budget of this one, but we must assume it's about the same. It's a dog in jeopardy, but you can feel rest assured all will be okay in the end. It made about $23 million since it opened up last week. And number five is The Hustle, an inferior remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels starring Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson. That made $15 million over the last few days. It's at $51 million worldwide. And number six is a new film, The Gangster, The Cop, and The Devil. It made $9 million. It is a con midnight movie, so maybe Sperling saw it, though I think he didn't. It's about a cop and a criminal who join forces to hunt down a serial killer, and it comes from Korea. Sperling, were you up at midnight?
No, I was not. I only saw one midnight screening thus far, and you'll never guess who it was from.
I won't. Who?
Gaspar Noé.
Ah,
go figure.
Of course, of course. And it was miserable.
Lux Aeterna, I have to say, it's one of those films I'm glad I saw. I'm glad I saw it in Cannes. It's an experience that you can only get in Cannes. The last 15 minutes of the 53-minute movie is all strobes. If you have epilepsy,
run.
You will have a fit. Literally, he did that on purpose. And
well, he didn't do it on purpose to trick people.
No. He did it because he opens the film with like a quote about epilepsy. So yeah, he did it like...
Right. People are warned. He's not trying to trick people.
No.
Okay. So he didn't do it on purpose to cause people fits. He just says, hey, this movie involves strobes. Stay the hell out of the way if you have epilepsy.
No, he didn't say that.
No, he didn't, but they did, surely.
Nope. They did not say that.
Wow. Well, that's a bad thing from Cannes. Well, they should do that. Number seven is Long Shot, the romantic comedy starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen that made about $5 million over the weekend. It's at $35 million worldwide. And number eight is Ugly Dolls, a would-be animated film franchise, falling hard and fast. It's in 50 territories. It made about $4 million over the weekend. It's at $21 million worldwide. Doing better is the horror flick The Intruder that has now tripled its budget. It cost about $9 million to make. It's now made about $28 million, and that's only from North America. And at number 10, Unbelievable, Capernaum. This is the terrific film, one of the best movies of the year, very much an art house hit, but it is catching fire in China. It made $3.4 million over the weekend. It's playing in 16 territories, but it has now made $65 million worldwide. About $45 million of that and counting is from China alone. Well, her next movie will be greenlit no matter what. At number 11 is another new film. It is The Sun is Also a Star, which is both a teen weepy about two kids who fall in love but may be separated by the immigration status of one of them. And it's also an accurate astronomical observation. The sun is also a star. It made about $3 million on its opening weekend. Strolling down, looking for some new movies, there's a film called Twin. No idea what it is about, where it comes from. It's being distributed by CQSD. That's the abbreviation used by Comscore. It made about $2.8 million over the weekend. Sperling didn't have a chance to try and track it down. I couldn't figure out where it's from because the word twin is so generic and there's so many movies, it's kind of hard to figure out. So if you know what Twin is about, where it's from, the countries it's playing, and anything about it, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And we are, you know, we're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That's where you can like our Facebook page.
That's right. Scrolling down, I see another Cannes film. You know, you're not supposed to have most movies debut before Cannes, unless, of course, you're Almodovar, in which case Pain and Glory has opened up already in Spain. Now it's in three territories. Over the weekend, it made $2 million. It's at $8 million and counting. I know Sperling saw it at Cannes and you loved it, didn't you?
Yes, I have to say, I went in expecting very little, not only because of Pedro's recent work. I say Pedro because, you know, we're besties now. I don't know
right,
why
right.
I said it like that. I know we're going to, should we just wait to talk about this? Or
tell us about that film. You liked it.
Okay, so it stars Antonio Banderas.
And he plays an Almodovar-like character, a director late in his career.
A director late in his career with kind of crazy hair, who's gay.
He's Almodovar, yes. He's Almodovar-esque.
Yes, and he's got, you know, he's kind of ailing physically. And so he winds up visiting with one of his former actors who he hasn't seen in 30 years, who was a heroin addict and still is a heroin addict. And he tries heroin for the first time, which helps with all of the pains of his back and all of the, you know, ailments that he has. And it's just kind of a...
All right, don't tell us the whole plot. But yeah, so you loved it. You found it a mature, late work, really a return to form, etc.
It was really good. Yes, it was because it opened in Spain way back in March and it got like middling reviews from the Spanish critics. So we were like, oh, great, this isn't going to be good. Everybody left going, wait, what was everybody complaining about? It's really good.
And it's not an outrageous comic. It's sort of a quiet, mature work. Is that the idea?
Yes, very quiet and very mature. Yes.
Very interesting. Well, cool.
And by the way, the film is shot. I don't think it's shot in Almodovar's apartment, but it's a shot in a studio that is exactly like a replica of Almodovar's own apartment. With
what,
all of his
what
furniture
are these guys, Cuaron, Almodovar? They got to just recreate their childhoods or their home life. Okay.
I don't know. Maybe they just don't like going out anymore. Speaking of Cuaron, Stephen Garrett and I were walking out of the Palais through the artist's entrance, you know, that like back, you know, the secret exit. And we exited right behind Alfonso Cuarón. We were like, dude, get out of our way.
Well, scrolling back to the charts, way at the bottom is number 19. It's the last film on our chart. It's Heidi, which is a film based on the classic children's novel. I presume this is the 2015 German version starring Bruno Ganz, because I don't see any more recent version of Heidi. And also, it only made $1.2 million over the weekend, but its grand total right now is $30 million. So presumably, this German film is opening up in China, and based on the distributor, that's what it looks like. So China needs films, and they're going back to 2015 to pull a film which is worthy of being seen. It got pretty good reviews. So Heidi made good money at the German box office and around the world. China is sort of at a slowdown. You know, they've long had these blockades of saying, no, only a certain number of films can come. And they work around that figure in a lot of different ways. And they've expanded the number, you know, here when they need movies, they've got all these screens. Those barriers are going to fall. And here's another good example of that, reaching back to 2015 just to have something to put on the screen.
Yeah, and there was a panel discussion at the American Pavilion where one of the distributors, which it was a panel about Netflix that Ann Thompson actually moderated, and he was talking about how, yes, there's a quota, like 34, 35, 50, whatever it is now, and if you can get, you know, Chinese investment, then you become a co-production. So that was one
that
way.
That doesn't
they found
guarantee.
Around.
That's one way around it. Another way is you just sell the film outright. They buy it outright. Then it's their own film. There's lots of ways around those rules. So yeah, you've been at the Cannes Film Festival. You're having a good time. I know that from my years of going to Cannes, one of the big things was that you had to wake up really early in the day, as far as I'm concerned, and trudge out to the Palais for that 8:30 in the morning screening. Now, because of all the changes in the schedule, you don't have to set your alarm clock anymore, do you, Sperling?
Well, you kind of do, because you still have to set your alarm if you want to see certain films, which like an Uncertain Regard or a competition film will replay at 8:30 in the morning, but it won't play for the first time. So you're right. So for decades, I mean, ad time immemorium, you would have to wake up to see the 8:30 screening. Of course, you had to be there no later than 8:00. If you really wanted to sit down.
Well, depending on the movie. So are you finding, did you go to this morning's 8:30 a.m. screening?
No, because
you already heard bad news about the movie?
No, I was supposed to. I probably should have seen it. But I had stayed out too late with Stephen Garrett at La Pizza. And and Owen Gleiberman of Variety, the critic for Variety. And we were debating the merits of the Terrence Malick movie. And the next thing we knew, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, there's no way I'm getting up at 6 hours to go see the Brazilian film that I should have seen.
Well, some people say that Terrence Malick has had a return to form after about 3 movies that have been very increasingly poorly received and reviewed. He has a new film called A Hidden Life here at Cannes. It got certainly some good reviews, some very good reviews. People said it's his best film since The Tree of Life, which is a low bar given the 3 films he's released since then. Fox Searchlight.
I was just
going to
say that doesn't say much.
No, but however, some people say it's good, but Terrence Malick is not a commercial power at the box office. He's had one big hit film, which is
Badlands, right?
No, not Badlands, but the war film, The Thin Red Line, which made about $98 million worldwide. I don't know what the budget was, so that may not have even been profitable itself. But that's the only thing even remotely like a hit film he's had, even on the art house circuit. So A Hidden Life was bought by Fox Searchlight for the U.S. and some international rights for $14 million. That would be hard to make that money back, even if you had worldwide rights. So $14 million seems to me way overpaying.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a 3-hour movie that easily could have been 2 hours. And people came out of this, and I think it definitely split people, and I would say more people like it and or love it, really, than hate it. Stephen Garrett and myself both kind of left. He actually turned to me with an hour left. He said, "You want to go to La Pizza?" Like, it was that grating. And it's not like there isn't a story. There is a story.
But you said you liked it.
And I liked it up until the... No. Stephen Garrett and I both left going, you know what? You did not respect your audience. And I know that part of what you were trying to do is show, like, the, you know, it's a film that is set in Austria in the 1940s, and every Austrian man that was conscripted, everybody had to swear an allegiance to Adolf Hitler.
Of course.
And this one farmer...
He's the leader of your country.
Yeah, he has three kids and a wife, lives out in the, you know, no running water. It's a very primitive life, and he does not want to swear an allegiance to Adolf Hitler.
Okay, so that's the setup of the film.
And it's very religious, very religious.
Well, as is much of Terrence Malick's work. But putting aside your critical response to the film, $14 million for some territories is an absurd amount, given the grosses of all of his movies.
Yes.
You know, it just seems like a bad bet commercially.
Yeah, and it's not like all of a sudden he made such a big commercial film that, you know, it's going to break out.
This is not the Thin Red Line.
No, and to be honest
it's
with you,
filled
it
with
is
big
very...
movie stars.
It's beautiful to look at because it's Terrence Malick, but it's incredibly self-indulgent. He's in love with every shot that he filmed. It's just, it goes on way too long.
And so, and you gave it one star. You really did not like it.
No, I did not.
And Stephen Garrett.
And here's the thing. Uh-huh. I did not like it, but I would have loved it if it had actually been, kind of edited down.
Okay. The classic, it should have been shorter.
Yeah. Oh, much.
Well, so you've had a good festival. You've seen some films you really loved. Specifically Beanpole, which haven't even heard any buzz about yet. Tell us about it.
So this is a film, Beanpole, by Kentimir Balagov. And I know I'm going to mess up like what he's done before, but he is I didn't know this when I was watching the film. But he is like 27 years old, and this is a film that is set post-war Leningrad. So everything is rationed. People are dying of starvation, and it's about two women, and it's not a love story or anything like that amongst themselves. It's about their life, and it's really, really good. That's all I'll say, because to say any more would be to give too much away.
Okay, but it was terrific. Are other people talking about it?
Yes. People who saw it, it's beautiful to watch. It might be a tad too long. I'm not going to lie. It's just a little too long. Not, but that's part of its, it's so poetic and so beautiful. And it actually has a story, and the characters are it really works. The filmmaker's previous movie, Closeness, I think it was further down the Quasset or it was in Berlin. I can't remember. I think it was in the Critics Week previously.
Mm-hmm. And before that, he had a film called Molodoy Eshyo and a couple shorts, including a documentary short. He's born in 1991, so he's only 28 years old. And he's from the Autonomous Republic of Kabardino-Balkaria in the North Caucasus. So yeah. This guy is coming out of nowhere to make some movies. So good for him.
Yeah, no, and it was a very good movie.
So
it's in the En Sortant Regard, so it's not competing for the Palme d'Or.
Right, of course not. And one other film that you really loved is The Portrait of a Young Lady on Fire. I'm very excited because it's directed by the French director Céline, how do you say her name?
Céline Sciamma.
Right, and she's terrific. I've interviewed her when her first film came to Cannes. She's a real talent. She's made a couple very good movies in a row, and now this one sounds like it's great.
Yes, it's a phenomenal film about a painter, a female painter, I think it's the 1800s, who goes to, I guess, is with somebody of aristocratic lineage, and she has to paint this girl, this young woman, but the young woman won't sit for it, so her mother says, you have to paint her without having her sit, and this painting is supposed to go to a suitor who she is kind of being forced to marry in Milan, Italy. So she doesn't want to marry this person. And
kind of. That's the fate of women throughout most of history. Kind of being forced. Yes, women were married off.
And then it's a love story between the two women. And it is beautiful to look at. It is beautifully told. It is touching. It is romantic. It is just a stellar movie.
And you loved it. And other people are very excited about it because this film is in competition.
It is in competition and it is doing incredibly, you know, the buzz behind it. There's a lot of buzz behind it. A lot of people liked it.
Terrific. So we've got a list of all the movies you've seen and what you thought of them so far. People can check it out in our show notes. But of course, one of the big early films was Rocket Man. We know what all the reviews are for that movie.
What are they? Because I've only been
Pretty positive, you know, generally like, oh, it's fun. It's not great, but it's fun and it's better than Bohemian Rhapsody, but that's a low bar. But, you know, they didn't like this or that, but it's a generally fun, phantasmagoria sort of film. My question is about the hoopla around it. Khan loves to have some big hoopla. Did they do a good job having a spectacle for this opening night film? Did you feel like a sense of excitement?
Yeah, I mean, people really wanted to see it. I think the big excitement is, of course, on Tuesday, tomorrow, Quentin Tarantino will be here for
I'm not saying there aren't other movies that aren't going to be big, but Elton John got worldwide attention. He duetted with Taron Egerton. I'm asking, did they have big parties? Did it feel like there was,
Yeah, they did have the big party, which my invitation, I believe, was sent to my French address.
What a shame.
Yeah, I didn't get one, actually.
Does it feel like Khan has, we don't usually go to parties. We're not trying to get into big events. We don't care about that. But you do get a sense from other people of whether it's a quiet year or a big year. How does it feel?
It feels like the films are very good. And as somebody said, a couple of distributors have agreed, the market is very much like the festival. Half full and half empty, meaning, you know, there definitely are not as many people here. You can walk into La Pizza. There's never a line at La Pizza.
Are there fewer press too? Really? Yeah.
There are fewer press. Knock on wood, you can keep getting into screenings. And I say that because, of course, tomorrow's the Tarantino and people have already asked me how early I'm lining up.
Where is the screening held at?
The Debussy. And that's really the big thing. So you started this whole conversation about saying we don't have to wake up early. So one of the big issues for years, like maybe the last 4 years or 4 years before last year, was that critics would see a film, it would then, the reviews would then post, and then that evening, there would be a red carpet gala for the official
premiere. And when the movie sucked, it would be sort of a downer.
Correct, because everybody would be like, oh, yeah.
And all they had to say to fix it was, you can't run your review in any way, shape, or form or post about it until the screening is over. That's all they had to do.
That's literally because everybody is afraid that they will literally go and pull somebody's badge, which they will do.
Well, of course they will. Yeah, they would have worked. It's not a magic, you know, there's only a couple thousand people to track and just say you can't post about it. And they wouldn't have. It would have been problem solved. And yet now you're having to see movies in a much smaller space, which is the Debussy. So when you're going to see Quentin Tarantino's movie tomorrow, what color badge do you have?
I have a pink badge.
So oh, it's you like little this. Son of a bitch. How do you have a pink badge? That's crazy.
Not only do I have a pink badge, but I helped Stephen Garrett get back to his pink badge because he arrived here and Stephen Garrett is here with the New York Observer and several other outlets and he's going to
Film Globe. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's going to write a piece or two for Celluloid Junkie. And he was downgraded to blue. A lot of people have been downgraded. The yellow line right now, yellow is like the lowest of tier of
yellow, then blue, then pink, then white.
Right. And it is that line, that yellow line is really long.
And they're not getting into anything if the first screening is at Debussy, I wouldn't even get in line because you're not going to see it. You have to wait to the second or third screening.
Yes, correct. Although you'd be shocked, they have been getting in because what they're doing is they've taken about 60 big journalists or 60 big outlets because they journalists pass these cards around and they've given them a special card and you can go to the Bazin, which is a much smaller, it's like 250, 300 seats, tops. And you can go there earlier in the morning at the 8:30 screening or the 10 o'clock screening, and you can go and see that evening screening so that if you have to file early, you can do that. But it's only 60 people. It is, I've been told it is a horrible way to watch the movie. It's not only
what does that have to do with the thousands of people who have a yellow badge? It doesn't lessen the number of people ahead of them. I mean, 60 people can't make a difference.
It's definitely the way they're doing it. It has been fairly decent to get into these screenings. It hasn't been the madhouse until tomorrow, I'm sure, when it will become a madhouse for Quentin Tarantino.
The Almodovar film had already opened up in Spain, so some European people had seen it. There hasn't been a big, big, big movie with a big name that people are clamoring to get into yet, right? So this is the first time.
Rocket Man.
Yeah, but wasn't that... Well, but surely they didn't get into Rocket Man.
They got into the kind of public and press screening. And that's
right.
The thing.
They had to
the
wait press for a screening, second screening.
The big press screening in the Lumiere is kind of a combined public press screening. So what they do is they force all the press to sit in the first like 12 rows of the Lumiere. So they're literally sitting on top of the screen. It is and which means they're trying to read the subtitles on a screen that is like 70 feet wide.
All right.
It's a horrible way to watch.
So they're just making the people who are there to see the movies, they're treating like dirt.
Well, I wouldn't
go
say
here,
that.
Go there. You have to, they're giving you bad seats. They're sending you here and there, making you wait till the next day, shoving you.
I don't mind. You know what? Last year they said, look, you can't see the film until it's screening, the premiere screening, which was fine. That totally worked fine. That was not a problem.
Well, that worked fine for you because you're not filing reviews. Right. So please think about the press in general and not your own personal needs. It's terrible. All they had to do was say, you can't post your review on social media or anything until after the film has screened in the public.
Which is, by the way, they did do that this year. They said
so what?
That.
They've still up and they still haven't gone back to letting you see the movies in the morning.
No, well, correct. However, what they used to do is the film would premiere at 7:30 one night. And then the very next day at 8:30 is when you got to see it as a journalist.
Right.
So at least now it's kind of at the same time.
All right. So you feel more well-treated, you're happy, everything's going
fine? Yeah, I mean, ultimately, yeah, it's fine.
All right. I love Terry Frimeau. We wondered if he would have to take a lot of dirt for having given Alain Delon a major honorary award. And, of course, that was the first thing many journalists asked about, and he was very peeved and annoyed. And he's like, look, we're not giving Alain Delon the Nobel Peace Prize. So clearly a little beleaguered. Is all that calmed down? Is there any big buzzworthy news item, or are people just going to see movies and not arguing about streaming anymore?
They're certainly arguing about streaming. That is definitely one of the things everybody's arguing about. Mm-hmm. They're also saying that China is not as big of a buyer here at the market. So that's kind of something to know. And really, if you look at themes that are coming out of this year's festival, lots of women empowerment films. And it's not like these are the same filmmakers that come back year after year. So some of these films it's not like they went, you know, searching for them. It just so happens that the people they like
are
telling these stories. Ken Loach told a story about the gig economy.
Well, yeah, Ken Loach is always, of course, going to be focusing on, you know, the working class, the poor people, injustice of the economic system. So that's no surprise. And that movie got pretty good reviews too, right?
Yes, and it was pretty good, actually. And then there's a film here called Les Miserables, shot in the very neighborhoods where Les Miserables, Victor Hugo's book, told the story about.
Right, there's a PBS originally retelling of the Victor Hugo novel, but this is a contemporary story about struggling poor people in France.
Correct. And there seems to be kind of like the masses rising up, kind of a feel to many of these.
I wonder why.
Yeah. And you know, like the Terrence Malick, halfway through the film, which is, by the way, an hour and a half. Okay, that's that. The hour and a half point, I said, oh my God, if he can keep going at this level, this is going to be a masterpiece because it will be allegorical to the current time about Trump. And no, he just kind of went on and on and on and didn't advance the story.
Well, speaking of streamers, Amazon, of course, picked up the French language film Les Miserables. And it also just picked up the a film starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, one of my favorite actors. It's a terrorist drama called 7500. So they are active buyers at Cannes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Amazon, Netflix, they're all here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's a big deal, though. There they are picking up films, you know, still being buyers. They're certainly welcome when they open up their pocketbooks.
And since you mentioned that they're welcome. And by the way, if you hear that, do you hear that bird behind me? I'm going to have
Nope.
You don't hear a bird? Okay, it's a seagull. Okay. And I've learned it from a movie called The Lighthouse that you're not supposed to kill a seagull.
Well, no, of course not. That'll bring a curse on your ship. But no, that looks like a cool movie. That's from the director of Witch or The Witch.
The Witch, yes.
Yes.
From Robert Eggers. And it is told in the Academy ratio, so 1:33. Very grainy black and white.
Only a distributor exhibitor would say something like that. It's told in the Academy ratio.
Well, very grainy black and white. And
starring Robert Pattinson, the future Batman.
Yes. And Willem Dafoe, who I think everybody feels like, okay, just waltz up there and get your nomination because he does a very good job.
He's almost never nominated, so he's hardly an overly nominated actor.
Four times.
Not a lot over his 40-year career with so many good movies, but does this seem like an Oscar-worthy performance?
Yeah, it does seem like one of those performances that could very easily, depending on what else comes along, you could say, yeah, all right, we get it.
Well, I mean, but it's hard for men. There's usually more competition. Does this seem like a film that will get end-of-year attention from the Academy? It's a horror film, or certainly a gothic film.
Yeah, it's a gothic film. It's not a horror film.
It's not a big movie. It's not going to get tons of... It may be on critics' list, but I don't think this is going to be an Oscar player.
It'll be like Cold War in that regard.
Cold War, okay. Well, that got multiple Oscar nominations.
Well, what I mean is the vibe and the feel of it, and I don't just mean because they're both in black and white. I just mean the critically acclaimed kind of film.
Oh, so it's really going to break out critically. Okay, great.
Yeah, I have a feeling it probably will.
I said big deal.
I know, and I was trying to get there, but then I got kind of sidetracked by myself, actually. The bird.
Blame it on the bird. Blame it on Hitchcock.
It's time
for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Sperling, what is our first story?
Well, as we mentioned during the last episode, Hollywood has been mostly mum about the new anti-woman abortion bill passed in Georgia and now Alabama, as we kind of referenced at the beginning of this episode. The state provides hefty incentives to lure some $3 billion of movie and TV shows to the state. Those who don't do business there can easily pledge to boycott. Others, like AMC, you know, they have The Walking Dead there, they are keeping their heads down and hoping the courts will block the bill and end this mess for them. But the latest strategy seems to voice your dissent, donate some money, and then go ahead and do business in the state anyway. That's the tactic of HBO's Lovecraft Country, which is country, not county, as we discussed on last week's episode, the upcoming Fear Street trilogy at Fox and Ron Howard's new movie, an adaptation of the best-selling memoir Hillbilly Elegy. Is this tactic going to placate activists, and is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. Businesses just want to make money. They don't want to have to think or deal with politics. I think it'll probably work okay. You know, it'll be sort of some people will get blamed and in trouble for it, and others will get a pass. You know, it used to be, oh, you shouldn't do business there. Now it's like, well, we'll object to it and donate money and maybe hope that's enough. That seems to be what's happening. But I do feel sorry for Ron Howard.
Why is that?
Well, because Ron Howard has been embroiled in some controversies over his career, including, you know, Beautiful Mind and other things. And he never sees them coming. And here he is again. He's adapting a best-selling memoir called Hillbilly Elegy. Lots of critical acclaim. He thinks he's telling an important story. But there's been a serious intellectual and I think a broad backlash against this memoir, which is sort of blaming the poor people for their own condition in Appalachia, paints Appalachian as all white. It's their own fault. You know, there's been a real turn on the attitude towards this memoir and how it portrays the people of Appalachia. And I don't think Ron Howard has a clue about that. And he's going to make this movie and find suddenly he thought he was embracing a film that progressives really liked, but it turns out, no. Actually, a lot of people have problems with it. And that's going to slap him in the face. And he has no idea that all that is coming.
Well, and I don't know. We talked about Terrence Malick's film. I'm not going backwards, so don't worry about that. We talked about Terrence Malick's film. The only reason I could see Fox Searchlight paying $14 million for this film, well, I really can't see any reason.
No, not commercially. No.
Yeah, no, but you know, the only way they can make it back is if they play it as a hyper-religious film, which it is. It is a very religious film. It is
all his movies are, sure.
Yeah, so.
But they're not gonna get in the faith-based crowd, you know, pouring in for the movie just because there's religion in it.
It's not about religion.
Yes, but not in the sense of a movie that caters or panders to your, you know, far right religious beliefs. It's a questioning film. It is not a film that says, this is the truth. This is a Correct. Questioning, reflective, self-critical film, asking yourself questions, challenging yourself. That is not what people who want to see faith-based movies that just sort of reinforce their previous beliefs looking for. They want comfort, not challenge. And that is not what Terrence Malick provides. And again, if you look at his movies, Song to Song grossed $1.7 million.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to go down. They're not very...
$1 million. Yeah. The Better Angels, To the Wonder, $1.5 million. These are not big grossing movies.
No.
The Tree of Life, though, made $60 million, so who knows?
Yeah, it was also nominated for an Academy Award.
Right, so but that was $60 million all over the world. I would want worldwide rights for $14 million.
Well, Disney, they went on a shopping spree, and it's still emptying all those shopping bags and sorting things out, we talked about it. The Fox Film Library, that came over to Disney. They resold the original sports networks, the regional sports networks. Sorry. Those were very cute, by the way, but they didn't quite fit. They was the wrong color for them, at least according to current government regulations. Oh, and there's Hulu, by the way, the streaming service known for airing repeats of shows from the major networks. Remember them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Disney has now taken operational control of the site. Comcast is still vested, of course, in it, but Disney is now the boss, and Comcast can force them to buy their share out by 2024. So other than push The Handmaid's Tale for more Emmys, what do they do with it? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. We expect these things to happen. We knew there was going to be some more wheeling and dealing when it came to Hulu. My question is, what is Hulu going to be 3 years from now? Are the other networks going to let Disney profit from showing reruns of their shows? CBS has CBS All Access. NBC is going to have their own streaming service. You know, this is over, right? Fox is not going to want to support it. So it's going to have to be an all original service, yet they've just launched Disney Plus. So I'm not sure what role Hulu plays anymore. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we want it a la carte. And guess what, people?
Yeah.
You know, you better be careful what you wish for, because you got it. And now you're going to have to pay for 30 different streaming services.
Well, hopefully all the competition of these Amazon and Google and YouTube, all these streaming services that actually bundle stuff at smaller amounts will force down the prices of the major cable companies. So hopefully there'll be some downward pressure, and we'll see as they start to lose more and more subscribers to other services. They're not stopping watching TV. But when they say, look, we want to be competitive, we got to stop charging $130 a month, get it down to $90 or $80, and they'll be competitive again. By the way, with this big merger of Disney taking over a chunk of Fox, no surprise, more people are being laid off, though this time they're doing it in a way to minimize publicity and cloud exactly how many people are getting the axe. It's really hard to figure out how many people are being fired right now, but there is another wave of firings, and this is what happens when massive corporations merge. It creates a behemoth, and it destroys good-paying jobs.
Yeah, and you know they can hide it for only so long, because eventually that number will come out.
Yeah.
The U.S. reality TV space, or, you know, daytime talk shows, really, it has calmed down since the heyday of Jerry Springer, Geraldo, and endless paternity tests. But the ugliness once on display here has a higher profile in the U.K., thanks to fare like The Jeremy Kyle Show. This bottom feeder specialized in highly charged confrontations between real folk, including lie detector tests. When one man recently insisted he was totally loyal to his fiancée but failed the lie detector test, he killed himself. And I mean that he literally killed himself. In the wake of this, numerous others spoke about contemplating or attempting suicide after their own appearances on the show. Mental health experts questioned the aftercare shows like the Jeremy Kyle Show provide. And now ITV has canceled the series outright after 14 years on the air. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, obviously, the suicide of someone is a big deal for the people who know them. Overall, I think it's a big whoop. Are we erasing all these shows? No, there's still an audience for it. It's ugly. It's nasty. I wouldn't want to be involved in it. It's amazing that they actually canceled the show. Obviously, it was still making money. It'd been on the air for 14 years. But all that ugliness is still out there, unfortunately.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I'll tell you, this whole debacle over the WGA and agencies, it may not be affecting you right now, but at some point it very well might if it lasts long enough. They really will have problems.
I don't think the word you want to use is debacle. That implies that they tried to do something and it was a disaster. Kerfuffle? No, let's just say battle or, you know, the ongoing struggle or something. Debacle implies a judgment that this was a ridiculous farce.
Okay. Hoo-ha. Right. How about hoo-ha? No.
How about
can
battle?
I get a hoo-ha?
No, you can't get a hoo-ha. Anyway, we are talking about the WGA and their fight with the Association of Talent Agents saying, look, we want talent agents who represent our best interests and nothing else. And we're not getting that right now. And it's a complicated issue. You think it's going to really start affecting production? Because things seem to be going smoothly. In fact, Gavin Pallone wrote a column saying, you know what? In the TV world, a lot of TV writers may not need an agent anymore. He's talking about something few people want to discuss, and it's not the intent of the WGA to do this, but he's saying, you know what, in the TV world, they may not be so very darn necessary. And so guess what? He's saying this stuff is working out pretty okay. The sharing of social, he's finding people finding work and all this sort of stuff. Speak to the people who aren't famous or well-known, but he's saying, you know what? Maybe that 10% isn't so worth it anymore. And that could be a really interesting long-term plug. Tell us who Gavin Pallone is.
Well, Gavin Pallone is a former talent manager, and he represented writers and actors, and he was kind of known as being a bit of a hothead. And he then went off and became a producer, and he's produced a lot of great TV shows. I want to say, I can't remember exactly what he produced. I want to say it was Bones, but I'm probably wrong about that.
Okay, well, keep going. So yeah, so he's a big player, and he's on the agent manager side. He's not a talent in the terms of what sort of representation he has, right? So
correct.
Him saying this is like, you know, a come to Jesus moment or a road to Damascus moment, whatever you want to call it.
Well, he's just seeing, you know, the writing on the wall, and you know, he's produced a lot of movies as well. Yeah, I believe,
like Zombieland, and yeah. You know, think My Super Ex Girlfriend. He's worked on. He was an executive producer of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes,
Gilmore Girls. He was an executive producer on Gilmore Girls. That's a great show.
And I know that he produced, one of Nicolas Cage's movies. I think 8mm, or was it the one before that? I don't know. It was one of his films when I worked for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he was a producer on 8mm, absolutely. And okay. Nick Cage had a deal at Cannes, I believe.
Yeah, well, he always has a deal at Cannes because he's always, yeah, don't get me started.
So there you go. So that's very interesting that Gavin Pallone would say that. But we do also have some bigger news. You know, some people said, oh, the wall is crumbling. A talent agency is signing the deal. Verve, this sort of literary-focused agency who represents mostly writers. They have no production company, they have no outside investors, and they have agreed to sign the no WGA terms of conduct. And they did
it with a most favored nation. So basically right. They're saying they'll be the first to sign it, but if other people come along.
Right, but they're not the first to sign it. 70 agencies have signed the code. None of them belong to the ATA. One of them belongs to the ATA. That's Pantheon, an ATA member. So, you know, I thought nobody had signed. And the headlines around this story about Verve made it sound like they were the first to fall. But in fact, 70 people have fallen. Most of them are not the big four. Most of the agencies who belong to the ATA have not signed, but one of them has, Pantheon. Now here comes Verve. So a lot of people have signed on to this. And yes, Verve wisely said, we want a most favored nation clause, which means if someone else gets a better deal, we get those terms as well. And they got changes to the contract requirements so that they can live with that. That's the requirement where you're sort of expected to provide contracts on demand. They went through some back and forth to get a deal that they're comfortable with. They say mostly what they are foregoing is TV packaging, though it's not clear.
Which
to me
they don't do anyway. So.
Well, it's not clear that they've never done that, but they're saying they are foregoing that. Yes. So it's they may have never done it. So again, they're saying, look, we don't do that. So why wouldn't we sign? So yes. So it's still they're a pretty considerable player and they're not a member of the ATA, but they do represent a fair chunk of people. And they're not alone. 70 agencies have signed the new code of conduct. I find that a little surprising. I had no idea.
I do wonder who some of those 70 agencies
they're
are.
Small, and very small agencies. They're not big enough to even belong to the ATA. But Pantheon's pretty big, and they're an ATA member, and they have signed the code.
Okay.
And here's a great news story you may not have seen.
I've seen this whole story about, I would imagine you're talking about Frank Darabont and the Walking Dead lawsuit.
Yes. So AMC is being sued by Frank Darabont and other people involved in the Walking Dead. And those people, the creatives are saying, look, you've ripped us off. You're hiding your profits. And AMC is saying, us? What about CAA? those guys ripped you off too. Look at them. They're the ones who did what you're claiming we did. Look what, and in fact, you're suing them for this very reason. They had a big conflict of interest and they ripped you off. And they're trying to use that as a sort of a, you know, to fend off the legal attacks against themselves. And so the battle between the WGA and the ATA has become a plot point in the legal battle over the profits from Walking Dead, one of the most profitable TV shows of all time. So fascinating that that would come up in that context. And you say, we didn't rip you off. CAA ripped you off. That's awesome, I think. But that shows you how wide-ranging the implications of this battle are. I don't think it's going to cause any TV shows or movies to shut down or things not to get made that might have been made otherwise. It may make deals a little harder to do. It may mean some new writers don't break through as easily because they don't have representation for themselves. And it's harder to break through when you're a woman or a person of color. Perhaps those people who haven't had a good credit already.
Well, that was Gavin Pallone's whole thing was that.
He's saying in TV, that's not proving such a problem.
Right, because of the technology that's available. You know, you can, you know, the WGA has a whole like method now, you know, through technology to, and basically we're talking websites, okay?
And the agents are saying, that's a joke. It's not as good. It's not as useful. And he's going, I don't know. Seems to be working okay.
I think the one area he might be missing is it's a lot easier to have somebody else negotiate on your behalf than it is for you to negotiate for yourself.
Fair enough.
Which is why the
WGA wants contracts so that you can get a general idea of what people are getting at that level on that type of show with that budget.
Correct.
If it was anonymized, to me, it would make perfect sense. Why they'd want to see your own specific deal as opposed to just, okay, a show at ABC, drama, 1 hour, got, you know, the writers in the staff room got this, the head writer got this. That to me seems information that would be important and useful that you could anonymize.
Well, a part of that, I was talking to somebody here in Canada. They said a part of the reason they ask for those contracts with names on them is for residual purposes. When they're actually getting the residual payments, they want to know, okay.
They want to make sure the writer isn't screwing them over?
No. Because very often the payment will go to the guild, and then the guild sends it on to the agent, or vice versa. The agent sends it on to the guild. You know, they actually need to keep track of it themselves.
But they don't even get most of them all the time, right?
Correct. Yes.
So that doesn't help them do residuals. Residuals go through the WGA?
Yes, very often, yes. Same with SAG,
by the way. Surely it would be one way or another. Wouldn't residuals be... Really?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it depends. If anybody knows, let us know.
Yeah. So that battle is not dying anytime soon, even though Game of Thrones has ended. The Walking Dead continues with the dead people. They're not dead, but some other people have unfortunately died. They're gone. And that takes us to the obituary section, where Herman Woke, the best-selling author, has died at 103.
I did not know he was still alive.
Yeah, he had his last book published just a few years ago about his sort of a light... thin memoir about his life. I glanced at it. It wasn't very good. I've never actually read any of his novels. Maybe I'll read The Winds of War someday. I don't know. But, you know, he was a much adapted best-selling author, and he wrote novels and they were turned into plays, movies, miniseries. His big breakthrough Pulitzer Prize winner was The Caine Mutiny. Smash play, smash novel, smash hit film starring Humphrey Bogart in one of his iconic performances. And he had two big, big TV miniseries starring Robert Mitchum, The Winds of War and War and Remembrance. The scale of them was just epic. The Winds of War ran for 15 hours. It averaged 80 million viewers an episode. 80 million.
Yeah, I remember that. That's how it was such an event, The Winds of War.
Oh, it was a big, that was the era, peak era for the TV miniseries. Be a good book to write about the TV miniseries. That era has sort of gone. In a way, it's come back a little bit, but that was a very specific era in television where they would create these one-time events and they drew huge audiences. And so they did a follow-up, of course, War and Remembrance. They already had the novel. That one ran 30 hours rather than 15 hours. It cost $100 million, which was a huge amount for a miniseries. And it did not do that well. It did fine. They probably made money on it, but it was not as big a smash hit as the original. But he's got an interesting career. He started in radio, writing gags for Fred Allen. He's kept a diary starting in 1939, which he donated to a library, 100 bound volumes of his diary.
What is he writing about? Like for
his life. Today I wrote some more. I had tea and cookies. I don't know.
I mean, come on. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, he's a great guy. I never spoke to him. I've never read any of his books, but certainly most of us have seen some of what he wrote because it's been adapted so much on the stage and screen.
Well, and I know that you've seen some of the work of actor and comedian Tim Conway because he was on the Carol Burnett Show.
That's right. He died at 85. This I didn't know. He was discovered by Rose Marie. You remember her from the Dick Van Dyke Show?
I do.
Yeah, she's a great actress on that show. And she discovered him and got him a stint as a regular for Steve Allen, not Fred Allen, but Steve Allen. So he became a part of his players. A couple times they tried to launch TV shows built around Tim Conway, but he was a classic second banana. You know, he's the guy you want to see in little short spurts, not as the lead of a show. But he had a big hit with McHale's Navy. He was a sidekick on there, a clumsy goof. And he did voices on cartoons ranging from Scooby-Doo to SpongeBob, SquarePants. And of course, he's always remembered for the Carol Burnett Show. He guested on it for years and didn't actually officially join the cast until 1975 for their last four seasons. That show ran from the late 60s through 1978. And he was only officially a member of the cast for the last 4 years. That blows my mind. But then I remember, oh yeah, 1975, I was just 9 years old. So of course, it seemed like he was always on the show.
Did Tim Conway give Carol Burnett an award recently, or was that somebody else? I don't think it was Tim Conway.
I don't think it was Tim, but no, she was on an award show and did a great little speech. It was a lovely, classy speech. I remember that. I forget where that was.
The Golden Globes, or maybe it was.
Yeah, they renamed
Emmys.
They renamed the TV Icon or Legends Award after Carol Burnett.
Right.
And so she was introduced and gave a lovely speech. Yeah. So yeah, he's a great time. He won six Emmys, six-time Emmy winner as a performer and a writer. He also appeared regularly on Coach and 30 Rock in a sort of recurring roles. But I love this story. Asked in a 2011 interview about Comedy Today, he said, "I hang on to the oldies." You know, Jonathan Winters, one of the great classic, you know, improv comedians. He said, "Jonathan Winters calls me about three times a week and I never answer the phone." And I thought that was the joke, right? But no, what he was saying is that Winters would leave elaborate voicemail messages. He says, "I have all of his messages recorded. He always called with a different character and he wants me to do something or appear somewhere or go to an Army Navy store for something. I have hundreds of these on the answer machine, but I never talk to him. Once in a great while, I will pick up and talk to him." But I'm like, oh my God, I want those voicemails. I hope his family has found them and will make them available to the world, because 100 messages of Jonathan Winters improvising would be a real delight to be able to hear. So if I'd seen that, I would have called him up and said, "Tim, let us record those digitally, for God's sake."
Well, also, you know, I guess since we're on obituaries, Ian Pei died at the age of 102, since we're only doing centenarians, apparently.
That's right.
That said, I worked in Ian Pei's building. He did the Creative Artists Agency building in Los Angeles, and I worked there for several years. And, of course, he also did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
Yeah, and he also added the Louvre, the pyramid to the Louvre when they did a new entrance for the Louvre. That was a huge controversy at the time, but has now become accepted as really iconic and wonderful and great. He was a real rock star of an architect, one of the few known by name by the wider public. And like you say, he did that previous CAA headquarters in Beverly Hills. That opened up in 1989. Now they've moved to Century City. And I think the old building is now a Starbucks, isn't it? No.
It's Sony Music, the headquarters for Sony Music. And no, it's across the street from a Starbucks. That much I do know.
Well, that's true of pretty much all of us.
Exactly. Except for me right now, I'm not across the street from a Starbucks. There aren't that many. Well, actually, there are more and more of them in France.
There? Are there? Yes. Oh, isn't that sad? Well,
there's one in the train station, actually, the Cannes train station.
Ah.
Yeah. And also, right after we finished recording last week, Doris Day died at the age of 97.
Yeah, she was a major movie star and an even bigger success as a singer, at least creatively, I think. But she was one of Hollywood's biggest stars from the 50s and 60s, a real big talent. She was a dancer as a kid, but a car accident kept her waylaid for a year, so she took singing lessons. So then she broke through as a singer at the end of World War II with the big smash hit Sentimental Journey. A lot of soldiers coming home at the end of the war just cottoned to that song, and that became a real heart tugger, a sweet, but bittersweet song that a lot of people loved. It became a big, big smash hit. And she was done. You know, she'd been there. She'd been a singer. She was about to leave Hollywood for home. She never really thought about a movie career, but she attended a party, sang a song, and someone said, hey, kid, you need to do this role. She landed the lead role in her first movie. It's not even the lead, actually. It's a supporting role. Betty Hutton had to leave due to pregnancy. They tried a few other actresses. They weren't available. So director Michael Curtiz said, you, I want you in Romance on the High Seas. And he went on to direct her in a number of movies, begged her not to take acting lessons. He said, no, 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 your essence, you are Doris Day, no matter what you do. That is perfect. It's precious. You will always be that. Don't ever mess with that. For the love of God, do not take acting lessons. And so she didn't. And she had a big career.
Well, yeah. And she was like a big animal rights, you know, animal lover.
Oh, absolutely. You know, she had four failed marriages, each husband worse than the last, really. One was abusive, the first, another one ripped her off and left her when he died penniless. That's why she did the Doris Day TV show, to try to make money and pay off all the debt he had accrued. So she had one incompetent husband slash manager after another. And in fact, she's got some great recordings, but the reason she doesn't have more is because they never wanted to spend it. They just wanted to churn out money. You know, they never wanted to care about quality, like rush recording sessions, junky stuff just to make a dollar. They never thought about crafting a career for her. So for all the great music she has, if you say, you know, my speaker, I won't say in a sure or Alexa, if you say, you know, play me Doris Day, you're just going to get After Sentimental Journey and Que Sera Sera. You're going to get a bunch of junk, mostly. Maybe you'll get It's Magic or perhaps. But there's a lot of junky songs in there. If you actually pick some of her classic albums, though, you will get some great music. But she did Hitchcock, The Man Who Knew Too Much. Her favorite role was Calamity Jane. She did all the pillow comedies with Rock Hudson, which we all giggle at now. You know, she was annoyed by her virginal image as the girl next door, but she turned down The Graduate because it offended her sensibilities. So, Doris, I think you protest too much. And if you're wondering why she never got an honorary Oscar, it's because she kept turning it down. They really wanted to give her one, but she just did not want to go to the ceremony. She wanted people to remember her as she was, not as she is now, which is a shame because people would have loved to have celebrated her and seen her. But she, you know, she's true to the end. She wants no funeral, no grave marker, nothing. And only two actresses in the entire history of Hollywood have been the number one box office draw for four different years: Doris Day and Shirley Temple. Nobody else. So that's how big a star she was.
If anybody's gotten to three, like, you know.
Well, undoubtedly, undoubtedly. Yeah. Perhaps maybe Julia Roberts did it. You
right,
know, but,
exactly. That's where I was headed with that.
But it's hard. You know, Julia Roberts is in the era of Tom Cruise and some others. It's very hard to be the biggest draw year after year after year. But if you're looking for an album of hers to play, I can recommend three of them: Day by Day, or Day by Night, those are very easy to remember, or Annie Get Your Gun with Robert Goulet, which is a studio recording of that classic sound of the cast album. That's terrific as well. So, you know, if you want to pay tribute to Doris Day, don't just say, hey, play me some Doris Day. Why don't you listen to one of her classic albums?
In fact, why don't you listen to our podcast this week and next week? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. You can rate and review the show there. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're on Facebook, and you can like us there, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Now, Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. Was it this week, Michael?
This week it's ksarasara.com.
A reference to Doris Day. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.